Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this January 2011 Science News Update. Happy New Year. I'm your host for this evening's off-kilter distractions, Jim Campanella. Let us begin. The first story of the night was actually the result of an interview that I had with Jesse Willis of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Audio Podcast. You can actually listen to this. It is online now if you're curious and want to hear more. But Jesse and I were discussing one of my early podcast stories about human beings being genetically programmed to find babies cute because of their round heads and big eyes. This is something actually well known to artists. Even Walt Disney employed it when he retooled Mickey Mouse from his Steamboat Willie days. Compare the drawings of Steamboat Willie to modern Mickey. You will notice the infantilization of Mickey's features. Stephen Jay Gould, the famous evolutionary biologist, describes these changes in Mickey better than I ever could. Now, bear with me. This is a little long, but a fascinating quote from his article in the Journal of Natural History from about 20 years ago. Quote, "The characteristic changes of form during human growth have inspired a substantial biological literature. Since the head end of an embryo differentiates first and grows more rapidly in utero than the foot end, a newborn child possesses a relatively large head attached to a medium-sized body with diminutive legs and feet. This gradient is reversed through growth as legs and feet overtake the front end. Heads continue to grow, but so much more slowly than the rest of the body that relative head size decreases. In addition, a suite of changes pervades the head itself during human growth. The brain grows very slowly after age 3, and the bulbous cranium of a young child gives way to the more slanted lower brow configuration of adulthood. The eyes scarcely grow at all, and relative eye size declines precipitously. But the jaw gets bigger and bigger. Children, compared with adults, have larger heads and eyes, smaller jaws, a more prominent bulging cranium, and smaller, pudgier legs and feet. Adult heads are altogether more apish, I'm sorry to say. Mickey, however, has traveled this ontogenetic pathway in reverse during his 50 years among us. He has assumed an ever more childlike appearance as the ratty character of Steamboat Willie became the cute and inoffensive host of a magic kingdom. The Disney artist transformed Mickey in clever silence, often using suggestive devices that mimic nature's own changes by different routes. To give him the shorter and pudgier legs of youth, they lowered his pants line and covered his spindly legs with a baggy outfit. His arms and legs also thickened substantially and acquired joints for a floppier appearance. His head grew relatively larger and his features more youthful. The length of Mickey's snout has not altered, but decreasing protrusion is more subtly suggested by a pronounced thickening. Mickey's eye has grown in two modes, first by a major discontinuous evolutionary shift as the entire eye of ancestral Mickey became the pupil of his descendants, and second by gradual increase thereafter." Unquote. I base my statement about babies to Jesse on the work of the famous psychologist and behaviorist Dr. Conrad Lorenz. Lorenz, in several articles, argues that humans use the characteristic differences in form between babies and adults as important behavioral cues. He believes that the features of juvenility trigger, quote, innate releasing mechanisms, unquote, for affection and nurturing in adult humans. When we see a living creature with babyish features, we feel an automatic surge of disarming tenderness. The adaptive value of this response can scarcely be questioned, for we have to take care of our babies after all. Lorenz, by the way, lists among his releasers the very features of babyhood that Disney affixed progressively to Mickey. Quote, "a relatively large head, predominance of the brain capsule, large and low-lying eyes, bulging cheek regions, short and thick extremities, a springy elastic consistency, and clumsy movements," unquote. Okay, so is there a point to all this? Well, late in the conversation that I had with Jesse, we got into an odd argument which basically was a question about outliers in human behavior. Jesse wanted to know, if Lorenz's hypothesis is true, then why is there still infanticide in the world? Why do we hear about people killing babies and small children? Well, my immediate response was that those baby killers had a screw loose. They were psychologically disturbed and were overriding Lorenz's releasers. This is actually the same argument that the Roman Catholic Church now uses to explain why people who commit suicide probably do not suffer eternal damnation. It is no longer you have to be deeply disturbed. and not in your right mind to actually kill yourself. At any rate, I didn't ask, but I bet that Jesse is not a parent. A parent would never have asked me that question. Anybody who has had to deal with a screaming baby for hours at a time, especially in the AM, will tell you that by the end of 4 or 5 hours of continuous screaming, even the most loving parent will be considering homicide, if not suicide. Another two possibilities for the existence of infanticide would be the following. First, Lorenz argued that the recognition and response to the baby releasers was innate and hardwired. Let us imagine someone who is a mutant who does not have a brain which is hardwired for those releasers. A quote-unquote wild-type person would simply live with the 4 hours of baby screaming and probably take to the whiskey bottle after the child had calmed down. Let us imagine the mutant who has shown little predilection for murder in their life. Perhaps they've been a little cruel to small animals, but that's about it. Their brain is simply wired differently, and what keeps you or I from killing a child because they are cute and helpless simply does not exist in this person's brain. When they, he or she, is exposed to endless hours of crying, they react eventually by trying to end that crying as best they can. Gould suggested that it may not be a hardwired recognition, but a learned process of inculcating an appreciation for cuteness into your brain. Imagine a person who has never been exposed or never learned the psychological lesson. Again, it would lead to the same conclusion. They do not know the releasers because they never learned them. Okay, if that does not answer the question, you may want to search out a 2010 article in the journal, and I'm not making this name up. The name of the journal is Trauma, Violence, and Abuse. The article is entitled Infanticide and Neonaticide, a review of 40 years of research literature on incidents and causes by Drs. Helen Gavin and Teresa Porter of the University of Huddersfield and Connecticut Hospital, respectively. This review seems to be the best source at the moment of answering a very complicated question. The article reviews and summarizes research, incident statistics, and judicial and clinical outcomes ranging over 4 decades of work and sets out the various ways in which the prevention of infant murder may come about. You can peruse that paper, but in the end, I suspect that we will never have good explanations of why people commit monstrous acts. And Jesse, they are outside the norm. A majority of humans, the wild type, to use the genetic term again, do respond to Lorenz's releasers and do find baby-like creatures cute. I mean, Disney made his fortune on an understanding of this. The second article of the evening is an update on the BEM article from December. You may remember that was the one that seemed to find evidence for precognition. You may also remember that I was more than a bit skeptical and that I suggested that Dr. BEM's statistics seemed to be skewed and a bit hard to accept. Well, it turns out I'm not the only one who did not jump at BEM's data and conclusions. Doctors Eric Jan Wagenmachers, Ruud Wetzels, Denny Borsboom, and Han Vandermas wrote an article for the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology entitled Why Psychologists Must Change the Way They Analyze Their Data, The Case of Psy. To say that this group of Danes was disturbed by BEM's article is putting it mildly. Here is a quote from their paper to put it into context. Quote, "We think that the answer to the question of whether psi exists or not is negative, and that the take-home nature of BEM's research is, in fact, of a completely different nature. Instead of revising our beliefs regarding the existence of psi, BEM's research should instead cause us to revise our beliefs on methodology. The field of psychology currently uses methodological and statistical strategies that are too weak, too malleable, and offer too many opportunities for researchers to befuddle themselves and their peers," unquote. The authors then listed several flaws in BEM's psi experiments in terms of his analytic methodology. First, BEM was confused between exploratory and confirmatory studies. Basically, that means that BEM was doing some basic exploratory research to try to find any evidence for his hypothesis. But upon finding any evidence at all, he decided the evidence was good enough to confirm his hypothesis. As the Danish paper suggests, instead of presenting exploratory findings as confirmatory, one should ideally use a two-step procedure. First, in the absence of strong theory, one can explore the data until one discovers an interesting new hypothesis. But this phase of exploration and discovery needs to be followed by a second phase, one in which the new hypothesis is tested against new data in a confirmatory fashion. The second flaw, BEM did not give sufficient attention to the fact that the probability of the data given the hypothesis does not equal the probability of the hypothesis given the data, something called the fallacy of the transposed conditional by scientists. The interpretation of statistical significant tests is liable to a misconception known as the fallacy of transposed conditional. That means the probability of the data given a hypothesis, such as the probability of somebody being dead given that they were lynched, which is a probability that comes close to 100%, is confused with the probability of the hypothesis given the data, such as the probability that someone was lynched given that they are dead, which is a probability that is close to zero. In short, you are assuming that just because being lynched leads to being dead, then all people who are dead must have been lynched. From a scientific standpoint, this is a logical mistake of colossal proportions and the basis of Laplace's principle, which states that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. This principle holds that even compelling data may not make a rational agent believe that psi exists. Basically, if psi exists, then to make a rational human believe it, BEM needed to get much stronger data than he did. His lousy, weak, almost believable data is simply not enough given the extraordinary hypothesis he is trying to support. As the Danes say in their paper, quote, "Thus, in order to convince scientific critics of an extravagant, controversial claim, one is required to pull out all the stops, even when BEM's experiments had been confirmatory, which they were not, and even if they would have conveyed strong statistical evidence for precognition, which they did not. Eight experiments are not enough to convince the skeptic that the known laws of nature have been bent, or more precisely, that these laws were bent only for erotic pictures and only for participants who are extroverts," unquote. Now, the last flaw. BEM applied a statistical test that overstates the evidence against the null hypothesis. The use of that statistical test created an unfortunate tendency to give bad statistical conclusions that are only exacerbated as the number of participants grows larger. As the Danes state, evidence is a relative concept, and it is of limited interest to consider the probability of the data under just a single hypothesis. For example, if you win the lotto, you might be accused of cheating. After all, the probability of winning the lotto is rather small. I mean, this may be true, but this low probability in itself does not constitute evidence. The evidence is assessed only when this low probability is pitted against the much lower probability that you could have somehow obtained the winning number by acquiring advanced knowledge on how to buy the winning ticket. In order to evaluate the strength of the evidence that the data provide for or against precognition, BEM needed to set the null hypothesis against a specific alternative hypothesis and not consider the null hypothesis in isolation by itself. The Danes suggest that Bayesian statistics can achieve this goal using a hypothesis test that computes a weighted likelihood ratio, apparently something that BEM did not do. In the end, the Danes did those statistics that BEM did not. They reanalyzed BEM's data using a default Bayesian t-test and finally show that the evidence for psi is weak to non-existent. Ta-da! They conclude that the best thing that we can learn from BEM's work is that experimental psychologists need to change the way they conduct their experiments and analyze their data, which is something I've been saying for years. I'm often amazed that psychologists actually do take classes in statistics, and given some of the things that I've read. Onward and upward. One of my friends and colleagues here at the university is a behavioral biologist and teaches courses specifically having to do with physiology and evolution and their effects on reproductive behavior. It always amazes me how popular his classes on animal sex are, but there are a ton of students who sign up for them. I suspect it is because, as humans, we are always curious about the reproductive behavior of animals and whether it will give us any insight into our own behavior. This next story reminded me of my colleague when I read it because it has entirely to do with animal behavior and sex. Dr. Jonathan Pruitt of the University of California, Davis, spoke on spider sex at the January 4th annual meeting of the Society for Integrative and Comparative Biology. The title of his talk was, "Early Mock Sex for Spiders Yields Later Benefits for Young Arachnids." Now, what exactly does that mean? Among the Anelosema spiders, which live and spin webs along rivers and under bridges all the way up and down North and South America, females don't develop an opening to their reproductive tract until their final molt. Males mature faster and hang around not quite so mature females, often going through most of the mating routine. They don't actually have sex because A, there's no female opening to do that, and B, the male doesn't load his sex organs with sperm, but performs a courtship display by drumming the female's web with his legs and sex organs. If the female assumes a cooperative posture, he approximates a mating position too. Then he taps her body where the reproductive tract will eventually open. Now remember that female spiders can be quite nasty to their suitors, even during mock sex, so there is still a risk that the male spider will be killed by a potentially cannibalistic female. So the question that Dr. Pruitt raised was, why? Why do this when you risk being killed for no reason at all? Pruitt says that sex that can't possibly produce offspring remains puzzling. To test the idea that such encounters might be more than wishful mistakes on the part of the males, he and Dr. Susan Reichert of the University of Tennessee played matchmaker to some young spider pairs for these near matings. At the same time as setting up a control, they kept other mature individuals isolated. When all the spiders finally developed, they observed actual real matings between males and females. They found that if either spider partner had participated at least once in a round of mock sex, a pair tended to reach the point of real mating faster than two inexperienced spiders did. Pruitt said, "The brisk proceeding wasn't a matter of knowing a particular partner, though. Even pretend sex with a different individual tended to hasten the process." Speed should benefit the male by reducing the opportunity for some intruder to dash in and displace him, Pruitt said. Timing matters because the first male will father most of the eggs in a particular egg case. And experienced females typically invested more in those egg cases as measured by weight, the researchers found. The test did not address whether females might find some benefit from this too, but Pruitt speculated that they might. For example, if mock mating turns out to be a sign of a superior male, then a female that rushes to consummate a real pairing reduces her chances of being distracted by some inferior interloper. At any rate, the next story is for anybody out there who is likely to be exposed to chickenpox in the near future. In the January issue of the Journal of Infectious Diseases, Dr. Eugene Shapiro of Yale University School of Medicine and his colleagues examined just how effective the chickenpox vaccine is. And the answer is one of those good news, bad news things. Bad news, the vaccine is not as effective as was thought with single injections. The good news, the vaccine, when injected twice, is actually quite effective long term. The chickenpox shot, available in the U.S. since 1995, has already proved able to prevent the disease in about 80 to 85% of the children who get the single dose. In 2006, the Centers for Disease Control and the American Academy of Pediatrics jointly recommended a two-shot approach, suggesting that children get the doses 4 to 6 years apart. A new study by Shapiro supports this revision. Adding another shot increases disease prevention by nearly 100%. In his study, Shapiro identified 71 children who had contracted chickenpox between 2006 and 2010, verifying the diagnosis with tests showing viral DNA and skin lesions. The children had attended 28 clinics in Connecticut. The researchers found that 5 of these 71 children hadn't been vaccinated at all, and that 66 of the others had received a single shot. But none of these infected kiddies had been vaccinated twice. As a comparison group, none of 140 other children who matched the first group in age and had gone to the same clinics had come down with chickenpox. Of this group, 117 had gotten a single shot, 22 had received two, and one child hadn't been vaccinated at all. The authors calculate that the two-shot regimen was 98.3% effective in preventing chickenpox, although for the life of me, I don't see where that statistic comes from. It seems to me that 100% of the children who got two shots did not get infected. Why 98.3%? I don't get it. That's just very strange. Shapiro notes the recommended 4 to 6 year separation in the two doses is based on convenience, allowing doctors to give the second shot with other scheduled vaccinations. The second chickenpox vaccine shot can be given as soon as 3 months after the first dose, he says. I can tell you that adding another shot into the pincushion-like regimen that my children get punctured with regularly will not make them any happier to go to the doctor. But if they can avoid the kind of nasty chickenpox I had when I was a child, then more power to them. The final story of the night is a bit of an update on one from a few months ago. You may remember that I reported a few months back that there was evidence for Neanderthal DNA in humans, suggesting matings between Homo sapiens and Neanderthals many thousands of years ago. There is new information in the December issue of the journal Nature by Dr. David Reich of the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard. Only about a year ago, it was still thought that modern humans spread throughout the world in a single migration out of Africa, and in so doing wiped out any genetic traces of other early hominids. This new study, however, suggests that the lineage of modern humans is much more intertwined and complicated than anybody would have thought or predicted. Researchers sequenced the full genome of a girl's ancient finger bone found in a Siberian cave. They concluded that there must have been a closely related sister group of Neanderthals living in Central Asia about 40,000 years ago based on these genetic data. The data also showed that, like Neanderthals, the mysterious group interbred with modern humans, in this case leaving behind a genetic fingerprint in modern-day Melanesians of Papua New Guinea and Bougainville Island, nearly 10,000 kilometers from where the fossil was found. This group, which the ancient girl's finger represents, is neither Neanderthal nor modern human. Earlier this year, Reich reported sequencing the mitochondrial DNA from the finger bone of the girl, leading the researchers to conclude that the girl belonged to a new group that split from the line leading to modern humans about 1 million years ago, before the Neanderthal-human split about 270,000 to 400,000 years ago. But the mitochondrial DNA, only through the female line, isn't as informative as genomic DNA in the cell's nuclei, so Reich and his colleagues decided to sequence the entire nuclear genome. The team found that the Denisovans, as they have been dubbed after the cave where the finger bone was found, were much more closely related to Neanderthals, who had their genome sequenced earlier this year. And comparing the Denisovan DNA to that of modern-day humans turned up a big surprise. DNA samples from people living in Melanesia carried 4 to 6% of the ancient Denisovan genome. Reich says, quote, "It's a really amazing observation, and it indicates there was gene flow from Denisovans into modern humans. This Denisovan genetic stamp isn't found in other modern human populations, however, suggesting that there was some sort of unique interbreeding event in Melanesian history, which likely happened after a similar genome mingling between Neanderthals and non-African modern humans." The study is one of the first examples of genetic information defining an entirely new ancient group. While details about the Denisovan girl's life are lacking, her cave may have been a busy place. Artifacts suggest that modern humans and Neanderthals were in close proximity to the region. The researchers also found a hominid tooth in the cave that Reich says is, quote, "like nothing we've ever seen before," unquote. Differences in the mitochondrial genome and the tooth DNA led the team to conclude that the tooth didn't belong to the girl, but another Denisovan. The large and unusually shaped tooth is presumed to be an upper molar from an adult. For now, details such as the Denisovan girl's appearance and cultural habits remain a mystery, Reich says. Quote, "All we have now is this tooth and this finger bone and this incredibly informative genome," unquote. After this new group's debut, Reich is hoping that perhaps more Denisovan bones will turn up. Well, we found hobbit-like ancestors. Perhaps the Denisovans are elves? Although more likely they sound like orcs from that weird tooth that was found. That's all from me for now. As always, take care, avoid infanticidal chicken-poxy spiders, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.